On Sunday, the Afghan capital Kabul hosted a webinar titled Muslim World Ulamas and the Recent Developments in Afghanistan. Top clerics from seven Islamic countries, namely Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Iran, Palestine, Iraq, and Croatia participated in the event. They said the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan opened a new chapter in the country, adding that it's up to the new rulers to form an inclusive government and maintain stability.
Afghans are proud people. They succeeded to defeat the U.S. and its allies and free their country. We hope the new administration learns from the past and understands that no one can rule over Afghanistan with dictatorship and oppression. I think Afghanistan must have a popular and inclusive government in order to prevent disputes.
We welcome the recent developments in our country, as it is meant to cease hostilities and violence on our soil. We are happy that our people don't hear the news of war every day, or at least hear lesser than they did during the invasion. But the fact is that recent terrorist attacks show that we are still far from permanent security and peace.
The attendees also stressed the need for Islamic solidarity and urged the Taliban and Afghans to stay awake and knowledgeable to foil enemies' scheme.
My advice to the Afghan people is that they should launch an educational movement and everyone should be illiterate, so that they can detect enemies' plots. In addition, there should be a solidarity between Muslim brothers because their enemies are trying to sow sedition between Shias and Sunnis, especially by carrying out deadly attacks.
Addressing the conference, the clerics also urged Islamic countries to help Afghans amid difficulties and economic hardship. The participants of the webinar stressed unity among all Muslims, especially in Afghanistan. This as the Taliban government is yet to be recognized by world countries and people are facing looming crisis. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A two-day photographic and film exhibition on the annual pilgrimage of Arba'in began in the Italian capital on Saturday. Arba'in marks the 40th day of the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Imam of Shia Muslims. It is commemorated annually through a march being the biggest in the world and known as Arba'in Pilgrimage from different countries to Karbala and holding ceremonies in the Iraqi city. The photo exhibition, organized by the Imam Mehdi Islamic Association and the NGO Arba'in Travelogue, showcases a selection of photos from the world's largest gathering in late September this year. The main focus of the initiative is global justice.
We do our best to bring the message of Arba'in to Europe, to every country, to every city, to every each of those people, and say the truth that Arba'in is follow the global peace, global justice. And global justice, global peace, global empathy is what we're missing now.
There is an amazing atmosphere in Karbala. Iraqi people welcomed us the best way they could. The first time I went there, Saddam Hussein had just been removed. I traveled all the way from Iran to the Holy Shrine. It was an unforgettable experience.
Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Shia Muslim pilgrims converged on Karbala in late September to commemorate the end of the 40-day mourning period for the death of Imam Hussein.
People at the photo exhibition say Arba'in should be seen as a model for our societies, one in which each and every one of us has a role, irrespective of our nationality, financial status, and ethnic or religious background.
I think it would be really nice to take it as a model because you see that everything is there organized by people who are doing their best without any rules, without any fines, without any pushing from the outside. So it can be implemented to our daily life. And hopefully I would say that the people could be inspired by it and try to have it in their daily life as much as possible.
What happens during the Arba'in can inspire our societies. Generosity, sacrifice, selflessness, these are values that better our societies, and that's what we should all aim at.
Some 14 million worshippers attended the Arba'in in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
Ten innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders. Hundreds were deported and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its predecessor that took a tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
Tens of thousands of workers belonging to South Korea's largest umbrella labor union rallied on the streets of downtown Seoul, defying a city government ban on their gathering.
The current infringement of basic rights by the government under the name of coronavirus prevention is a blindly criminal act which destroys the Constitution.
At the rally location in 1970, 22-year-old Chun Tae-il burned himself to death to protest against the terrible working conditions he endured. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit those in the service sector particularly hard, with layoffs and reductions in hours.
This year especially, many casual workers have suffered because of the coronavirus. They've lost their jobs and had their income reduced due to unpaid leave. We are holding this rally to stop this irrationality.
Demonstrators also protested the gap between regular and irregular workers and a growing disparity between haves and have-nots. South Korean truckers and railway workers have been threatening walkouts recently, with Hyundai union workers voting to strike Friday. South Koreans will be heading to the polls in about 5 months to elect a new president of the country. The main candidates have been decided, and now political forces, like the unionists here today, have begun to battle to see their interests top the campaign agenda. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a fresh air strike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeida province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeida Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeida, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeida, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldened Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a 2-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreements. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is the UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
It's called the Belarus-Poland migrant crisis, and the EU is faulting Belarus for it. It has decided to widen Belarus sanctions as the row intensifies. But is the EU hyping the crisis against Belarus due to its disagreements with the contested presidential election, which saw Lukashenko regain his presidency? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this migrant crisis has its roots at military action that EU countries, along with the U.S., have taken in different parts of the world, especially in West Asia. First, let's get the latest on this. Jerome Hughes is our correspondent joining us from Brussels. Jerome, welcome. So what is the latest that we have on this? We know that the sanctions were extended by the EU. Tell us about that and, of course, the reaction coming from Belarus, if there was any at this point.
That's right, Kaveh. Well, the situation seems to be escalating. There's no doubt about that. I've just been reading an article in one of the so-called mainstream media outlets, the New York Times, and it talks about the fact that the EU has spent billions of euro. This is something we've been saying on Press TV for many years now. The EU is sending billions of euro to countries, say, for example, in Africa, most notably Libya, and also outside of Africa, say, Turkey, to prevent refugees from coming here. So what we're hearing is, the analysts I've been speaking to, they say this smacks of hypocrisy, that we have a situation whereby the EU is criticizing Belarus, but at the same time, look at aid agencies like Oxfam. They describe it as Fortress Europe, in other words, Fortress EU. The EU is doing all in its power to prevent refugees from coming here. And whether you describe this, as morally reprehensible or, the ethics are all wrong, actually, under international law, the EU has an obligation because rich countries have to take in those seeking asylum. But the EU has a policy of pushing back, repelling refugees. You see 15,000 troops in Poland who are trying to prevent refugees from coming here. And so there is a lot of hypocrisy. And also, it has to be pointed out that we have a situation whereby the government in Minsk, let's face it, is friendly with the government in Moscow. And you have this constant provocation. You talked about sanctions, more sanctions on Belarus. And look at what the EU lawmakers have been saying during the debates last week in the European Parliament. Many of them, not the majority, but a sizable number, have been saying that sanctions don't work. Look at the situation in Moscow, in Russia. Look at the situation in Iran, South African countries, South American countries, I should say, and African countries. Sanctions don't work. It hasn't pushed back Iran. It hasn't pushed back Russia. That these countries are thriving in their own way. They have other allies in other parts of the world, like China. And so these sanctions against Belarus, certainly, according to the people I've been speaking to, the EU lawmakers, the analysts, they won't work either. Constantly we hear Joseph Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, he talks about Moscow or Russia having the same size economy as California. And it's this apart from the sanctions, it's this constant putting down these world powers, and it doesn't seem to work. Russia put the first man in space. Until Elon Musk came along, Russia, the only way the United States could get to the International Space Station was using Russian rockets. Two-thirds of the energy being used in the EU comes from Russia, and most of it passes through Belarus. So to try and belittle Russia, and you know, you could say its friendly neighbor Belarus, and putting these sanctions, the reality is they just don't seem to work.
Thank you for that. We appreciate that. That's Jerome Hughes from Brussels with the latest on that. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from London. Also joining us is senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And George Samioli, I'm going to start with you. Quickly, if you can, give us the short version of what you see as transpiring there on the Poland-Belarus border, how you view this migrant crisis, and whether it's being politicized.
Well, unfortunately, it is indeed being politicized. I mean, the European Union is playing quite a slimy game here. I mean, they really don't care too much about these migrants who are already now freezing in this icy winter temperatures. They want to score political points against Belarus, and of course they're trying to blame Russia for this, and Russia of course has nothing whatever to do with this. Look, as I think your correspondent pointed out, the EU has had these problems before. Erdogan in Turkey has something like 3-4 million refugees that he repeatedly threatens to unleash on the EU, and Germany regularly pays him off in order to stop him doing so. There are migrants who are, that are coming from North Africa, you know, when they're in the Mediterranean, they're shipped off to Italy. We have migrants crossing the English Channel, again, you know, whenever they're apprehended on the English Channel, the British ship them to safety. So what's so special about this case? Why is it that the EU is unable to do anything at all to help? Well, what's so special is they're coming from Belarus, and he wants to score points against Belarus. There's a very simple solution to this, which is pick up a phone, call Lukashenko, and ask him what is his price. I'm pretty sure his price is a lot lower than Erdogan's price. Belarus is a tiny country compared to Turkey, and all he probably wants is sanctions being lifted off Minsk. But the EU, for ideological reasons, isn't prepared to pay that price.
What was Turkey's price, by the way? Do you know?
I think it's something like 3-4 billion euros.
Uh-huh. Okay, so Marcus Papadopoulos, let me review with you this EU accusation and see what you think, where the EU has accused Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, orchestrating the influx of migrants to pressure it to back down over sanctions slapped on the government. Now, Belarus has dismissed that as being absurd. How do you view it?
The tension on the Polish-Belarusian border is not in itself about migrants. After all, America, Britain, the European Union, and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants to enter Europe as a result of Britain, America, NATO and the EU having destabilized both Libya and Syria through having supported terrorists in both countries. No. What we see at the Polish-Belarusian border is geostrategic politics in action, and specifically, Russia is the target. Firstly, America and Britain do not wish the Union state of Russia and Belarus, let us remember, Belarus is the historical name of Belarus. They do not want the Union state of Russia and Belarus to materialize, whereby Belarus will reunify with Russia. Why? Because in the event of the Union state of Russia and Belarus coming into being, Russian national security in Eastern Europe will receive a tremendous boost. Secondly, America and Britain are trying to foment civil unrest in Belarus in the hope that this will assist them in their quest to initiate a coup in Belarus aimed to bring down President Alexander Lukashenko, to wrestle Belarus out of Moscow's orbit and into the West's sphere of influence. And thirdly, NATO, which of course is directed by Washington and London, is looking for a pretext to increase NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic, and of course in the Black Sea region, which of course is an anti-Russia motivation. And as a result of the last few days, what we now see is NATO having its pretext to go ahead in increasing its soldiery and weaponry along the Russian border. As I said at the beginning, this situation on the Polish-Belarusian border has nothing to do with migrants. After all, there are only a few thousand migrants at the Belarusian, the Polish-Belarusian border. And yet the Americans, the British, the EU and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants into Europe a few years ago.
Right. Well, let's see here. First of all, George Samioli, do you agree with the assessment they're made and the analysis they're made by Marcus Papadopoulos?
I do. I think that there is clearly a strategic agenda here. It's been of long standing, which is to topple the government of Lukashenko in Belarus and thereby weaken Russia substantially. Let's keep in mind that the regime change that the Western powers engineered in Ukraine in February of 2014 was a strategic blow to Russia. There's no question. I mean, that having bad relations with a country that is basically kind of a brother nation that is Ukraine was a huge blow to Russia, and losing Belarus would indeed be something that would be strategically catastrophic. And that is why I believe that the EU and the United Kingdom and NATO want to continue to aggravate this crisis at the border and make this into this giant propaganda exercise in demonizing both Russia and Belarus. I mean, how are they? How is Russia in any way involved in this? And yet, if you listen to, or rather read the article written by UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss over the weekend, somehow it is all Russia's fault because Russia was supposed to have leaned on Lukashenko and told him what to do, which kind of undermines the whole idea that, you know, Belarus and Russia are kind of two separate states. So I think that there's no question that that is the agenda. And of course, as Marcus points out, I mean, we're only talking about a few thousand. So it is fascinating to see why this sudden hysteria about a few thousand when, you know, in 2015, you know, a million migrants were absorbed by the EU. And again, why focus there rather than on what's going on, say, in the English Channel? Are they coming from Belarus? Are the migrants that are coming from North Africa and going to Italy, are they coming from Belarus? So, you know, this is all a part of the kind of engineering this hostile alliance against Russia.
Okay, so we have what has been described by you, Marcus Papadopoulos, which the main target appears to be Russia, as you said. But looking at Moscow's reaction is a bit of an eye-opener, because from what we understand, Moscow sent nuclear-capable bombers to patrol the Belarusian skies and nations bordering Belarus as a result have voiced alarm because of that. How do you view Russia's reaction militarily here in terms of sending these bombers?
Belarusia and the Russian Federation, on paper, are two separate countries. The truth of the matter, however, is that Belarusia is de facto a part of the Russian Federation. The Belarusian armed forces are de facto a part of the Western Military District of the Russian Federation. However, whilst the chances of a Western coup succeeding in Belarusia are negligible, Russia cannot take any chances whatsoever. That is why Russia has learned from its mistakes it made regarding Ukraine at the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014, when the Kremlin was very, very slow to react to what was clearly a Western orchestrated coup in the making. So in regard to Belarusia, that is why the Kremlin has dispatched nuclear bombers to safeguard the borders of Belarusia and effectively the borders of the Union State of Russia and Belarusia. That is also why the Kremlin has dispatched Russian paratroopers to safeguard the border of Belarusia, which of course is also the border of the Union State of Russia and Belarusia. In hypothetically speaking, if a Western coup was to succeed in Belarusia and Belarusia was to be brought into the West's sphere of influence, that would be a catastrophic setback for Russian national security, because what it would mean is that the entire frontier of the Russian Federation in the West, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, would be enclosed with countries which are in the West's sphere of influence. And we know already that Britain has sent soldiers to Poland to, officially speaking, advise the Polish government on how to secure its border. My own personal view is those British soldiers should actually be in Dover, actually safeguarding Britain's border against illegal migration across the English Channel. And also, the British have said that they have 600 paratroopers and SAS soldiers ready to go to Poland if the situation deteriorates on the Belarusian-Polish border.
Okay.
So that is why Russia is taking the situation so very seriously, but also Russia is compelled to because of the Union State of Russia and Belarusia, which, I should add, will materialize sooner rather than later.
Okay, well, we do need to talk about the humanitarian aspect of this, George Zamioli, and the hypocrisy that's involved. At the top of the broadcast or the program, we had our correspondent talk about how what EU says and does is hypocritical, because it spends billions to stop these refugees from coming to the EU countries, even though as a rich nation they need to take in some refugees. We can have your reaction on that issue, and also how, for example, the U.S. Stops migrants crossing the border from, for example, Mexico, never mind the harsh treatment that these migrants receive. So are we sensing here a sense of hypocrisy from the EU and the U.S. also?
Well, yes. It is kind of interesting that the accusations against Belarus that, Belarus is to blame for the migrant flow. Well, no one in the United States would ever, at least no respectable person in the United States would try to do that in Mexico. They say, well, in Mexico is to blame for the migrant flow that's quite substantial into the United States. But in terms of the humanitarianism, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have these migrants now sleeping out in the cold. This is now getting, it's middle of November. It is very, very cold. And why is this happening? Well, it's happening because the EU, NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States want to use this as a massive propaganda campaign against Russia and Belarus, and therefore to show, hey, these are the people we're up against. So we've got a democracy summit that's scheduled for December the 9th and December the 10th, so it's in about 3 weeks' time. And, you know, what's going to be on the agenda? Well, the agenda will be the terrible people such as Russia and Belarus, because Iran will be included in that. But that it's part of the ideological mobilization that NATO is continuing to engage in. So they really don't care about the plight of these migrants. I think they're quite happy to have this on the news every night. And then they point to, hey, well, who's to blame? Well, it's these terrible people, Putin and Lukashenko. And, you know, and this is being done, stated explicitly by Western officials, as I say, by the UK Foreign Secretary, who's now, you know, going around mouthing this nonsense day after day.
So let's try to figure out through you, Marcus Papadopoulos, what is going to happen in this situation. One aspect of it, which was interesting, was the fact that the Belarusian President Lukashenko threatened to cut off gas supplies to Europe. And Putin said that he did not approve of that, in so many words. And he said that, I think, he said perhaps Lukashenko said that in a fit of anger. Do you see something like that transpiring? I mean, at this point, the EU has leveled sanctions. It may even go further. How do you see it?
No, I do not see gas supplies being cut off whatsoever. After all, as I said moments ago, Belarusia is de facto a part of the Russian Federation, and under no circumstances will the Kremlin allow anything to disrupt the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe. Why? Because in a scenario where the flow of natural gas, Russian natural gas to Europe, is disrupted, the Russian economy would suffer immensely, and would suffer immensely overnight. And let us not forget that the West's sanctions on Russia, which have been in force for coming up to 8 years now, are very severe. And one of the ways that Russia has managed to mitigate the losses it's sustained is by increasing the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe, but also to China. So undoubtedly, Lukashenko made that comment either in a fit of rage or to provoke the West, but under no circumstances will the Russian natural gas be disrupted in its flow to Europe. No. What we will see is, as a result of the tension on the Polish-Belarusian border, we will see NATO's presence increase in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic and in the Black Sea, and consequently we will see Russia and Belarus's initiative to initiate the reunification of the two countries come into play sooner rather than later.
Okay.
And the West has actually inadvertently sped up the integration between Belarus and Russia, because Moscow and Minsk clearly understand there is a very serious threat posed to Belarus by NATO and the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Russia will safeguard its security on its western border, and in fact increase enormously its security on its western border, is by ensuring that Russia and Belarus reunify. And as I keep on saying, that will happen sooner rather than later.
Do you think that a reunification is going to be the outcome here, George Samueli? Is it even required, given the fact that we know Russia does support Belarus in the form and fashion that it has?
Well, that's it. I think that the unification is it has been an ongoing thing, and de facto they are one country, particularly as Belarus is clearly under threat, and the only thing that saves Belarus is that it's that Russia has its back. I mean, you know, obviously there are lots of issues that need to be ironed out before they can become one state, but de facto it is one state, and that's, and therefore anyone who tries anything with Belarus knows that they have Russia to deal with, and Russia has made this very clear that in any attempt at staging a coup in Minsk will be met with force from Moscow. So yeah, de facto it is essentially already one state.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos from London. Thank you for your comments. And senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Damioli, spoke to us from Budapest. And we had our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, spoke to us from Brussels. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitale and entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations to the seminaries and religious scholars of ulama, which were issued in his fateful message and also in his testament. In today's program, we're going to touch upon Imam's advice to the executive branch of the government, especially the foreign ministry and Iranian diplomats. Stay with us for more. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to stress that if the executive branch of the government is not reformed, no remarkable result would be gained for the nation, even if there were good laws. He wrote in his testament, "Among the affairs that need to be reformed, purified, and cared for is the executive branch of the government. Sometimes progressive and useful laws may be passed in the parliament, and the Guardian Council may approve it, and a relevant minister may proclaim it, but it may go to unrighteous executors so that they would annul it, and contrary to the rules, or with the bureaucracies and twisting that they have got used to, or intentionally, they act in a way to make people worried, to gradually cause a row." Imam Khomeini considered honest bond with people and rendering services to them, especially to the less well-off and deprived classes, as an undeniable necessity of the Islamic Republic. He used to emphasize that neglecting the principle is religiously forbidden and would incur divine wrath. The Imam wrote, "The budget from which you and the employees of the ministries are paid from belongs to the nation. You should be the servants of the nation, especially the oppressed. And you should know that causing trouble for people and acting opposite to the duty is haram or religiously forbidden, and God forbid would sometimes incur divine wrath. All of you need the nation's support. It was with the people's support, particularly the less well-off and the deprived classes, that victory was achieved, and the hand of the oppressive kingdom was cut off from the country and its reserves. And if one day you are deprived of their support, you will be put aside, and, like the oppressive royal regime, oppressors would occupy the posts instead of you. In view of this tangible reality, you must try to draw the people's attention and refrain from un-Islamic and inhumane behavior. Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said in a famous speech to cabinet ministers and the government, he said, "Serve this nation which has cut off the treacherous hands and has put its trust in you. As long as you are such, the nation will back you, and as long as the nation accompanies you, no harm will occur to you and the country." The Imam writes to the foreign ministry and diplomats, "I recommend the foreign minister in this era and the next era to be heedful that your responsibility is very much either in the reformation and development of the ministry and embassies or the foreign ministry, safeguarding the independence of this country and the interests of this country, and good relations with governments which don't intend to meddle in our country's affairs. And seriously refrain from anything that is suspicious of dependence with all of its dimensions. And know that dependence in some affairs, although it may have a deceptive appearance or interest and use for the time being, however, it would draw the country to destruction." Imam Khomeini believed that an important step towards independence of the foreign ministry is to reinforce bonds with Islamic countries, and asked the diplomatic missions to embark on awakening the Islamic countries and inviting Muslim nations to unity and solidarity. The Imam wrote, "I recommend to the nations of Islamic countries not to expect anyone from abroad to help you in reaching the goal which is Islam and executing Islamic laws and rules. You yourselves should rise up for this vital affair, which will materialize freedom and independence." And the great religious scholars and respectful preachers of Islamic countries should invite governments to get rid of dependence on big foreign powers and to rely on their own abilities. In this way, they will embrace victory. And they should invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to the rule of Islam. And shake hands of brotherhood with their brethren in faith in any country and with any race, as the great Islam has called on them as brothers. And if one day this brotherhood in faith materializes with the efforts of governments and nations and the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power on earth. Imam Khomeini also warns staff of the foreign ministry by saying, "Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, I have issued recommendations to foreign ministers about development of embassies, which should be compatible with Islamic Republic. Yet, some of them either didn't want to or failed to take any positive action."
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.